Oh, yeah, and Children's Church as well with Claire up the back. So I was a bit late on that one.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Mitch. So, Brad, you can see. Can you see the script in the right? Okay. It's like I get very annoyed if I'm watching the news, watching the weather. I want to see what the temperature is going to be, and then the weather presenter stands right in front of the temperature. You can see the rest of the week, but you can't see today. What's the one I want? Yes, as Mitch said, we're going to be looking at the book of Obadiah, the small prophecy in the Old Testament, the minor prophets. Probably the first prophet, actually, was Obadiah, the first to be written. And it is the shortest, just one chapter. So seeing it is just one chapter, I thought we would read it. And I'll be reading from the ESV. So your translation might be a little bit different, but let's see how we go. So this is the prophet Obadiah. And he says this, "The vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. Rise up, let us rise up against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations, and you shall be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, you who say in your heart, 'Who will bring me down to the ground?' Though you soar aloft like an eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, and there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves come to you, if plunderers come by night, how you have been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? If grape gatherers come to you, would they not leave gleanings? How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. All your allies have driven you from your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They have prevailed against you. Those who eat your bread have set a trap beneath you. You have no understanding. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men out of Edom and the understanding out of Esau? And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter. Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. But do not gloat over the day of your brother, in the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. Do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of distress. For the day of the Lord is near upon all nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deed shall return on your own head. For as you have drunk of my holy mountain, on my holy mountain, so all the nations shall drink continually, and shall drink and swallow, and shall be as though they had never been. But in Mount Zion there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy, and the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble. They shall burn and consume them, and there shall be no survivor of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. Those of the Negeb shall possess Mount Esau, and those of the Shephelah shall possess the land of the Philistines. They shall possess the land of Ephraim and the land of Samaria. And Benjamin shall possess Gilead. The exiles of his host, of the people of Israel, shall possess the land of the Canaanites, as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Shephard shall possess the cities of Negeb. Saviors shall go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Amen. I should have told you about where the book of Obadiah was. It's kind of toward the end of the Old Testament, so you might have had a bit of trouble finding it, because it's only one chapter. Therefore, you know, if you go flipping through it, you probably won't find it. But that's the problem. My grandson has actually learned all the books of the Bible off, so he can actually rattle them, you know. I can't do that. Well, we are looking at Obadiah. Now, you may have heard or may not have heard of a man by the name of Johann Ludwig Burckhardt, who in 1812 discovered the city of Petra. The city of Petra is a city in the land of Edom, which had been, you know, a mystery ever since the Crusades. But this particular man, a Swiss explorer, if you like, discovered it, and for the first time, Petra became visible to Western eyes. It had not been so since the times of the Crusades. Local people knew about it, but it wasn't really known to the West at all. This was Petra, which used to be Sela, which used to be the capital city of Edom. Edom, of course, is the nation, is the country that was formed from Esau, the brother of Jacob. It is located in this mountainous region of Mount Seir. Now, Mount Seir was given by God to Esau, the brother of Jacob. That was going to be his dwelling. So Mount Seir was accessed, or is accessed today, as is Petra accessed today, by, yeah, these this place in Petra, by what they call the Sikh, S-I-Q, which means it is a split in the mountains that goes some 80 meters into the air and is at its narrowest point about 3 meters wide. And you go into this particular crack in the rocks, and it continues for over a kilometer into the mountains. And it widens out at certain points and narrows down at other points. And this is where all these creations were made. They were not made by the Edomites. They were made by an Arab peoples called the Nabateans, who came from Arabia and basically displaced the Edomites. And they built the Petra that we see today. Originally, the Edomites lived high up in the mountains. Now, you may have noticed in the reading, it talks about them living in the clefts of the rocks, because that's where they were. They were like the eagles. They lived on high. They could, apparently, from where they lived, you could see all the way to the Dead Sea. Because, of course, their land was between the Dead Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba in the south. So this that we see today, with all these Grecian architecture, temples, theatres, buildings, was built by the Nabataeans. And it is quite a work of art, as you can see. Monstrous place. And there it was, a mystery. No one knew about it for a very long time. It also is a dangerous place. If they have a flash flood, apparently, and you're caught in there, you can be in real trouble, because there's not much space and the water will just rush in and then you have a bit of a problem. Well, it was here, by the way, that one of the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade movie was partly filmed. There was a section, apparently, that was filmed in Petra. And it was, as I quote, where archaeological fact bound to Hollywood fiction. So I presume it was some other place other than Petra when they actually made this movie. We had the cities of Sela, which was the capital of Edom, and also Bozrah, which also was another large city. Teman was a son of Esau, and there's a place was named after him as well. Hence, he is mentioned in the prophecy. Well, for the most part, the book of Obadiah, as you heard, pronounces judgment upon Edom, upon the people of Edom, the offspring of Esau. It is also called a doom song. So it's not a very pleasant thing if that's you that it is speaking about. Obadiah's message was concerning when people set themselves in opposition to the people of God, they can expect doom. It's much like the, there's a proverb says, better to meet a bear robbed of her cubs than a fool bent on folly. And of course, always the bear robbed of its cubs becomes the figure of, don't upset someone who has a lot of power if you're going to, by interfering with their offspring, their children, their cubs. And if you touch Israel, someone's going to get angry, and it's going to be he who loves Israel. It's going to be he who has adopted Israel as his own people. And that is the lesson, I guess, of Obadiah, because that's what they did. Verse 15 says, as you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return upon your own head. Also, pride comes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, says Proverbs. So Edom became proud, became haughty, and became high-minded because they sat upon high, where they could survey all that was around them, and they looked down upon their brother Jacob. The book is divided up, as I have suggested here, two major parts. The first is concerning the nation. So it is a prophecy against one nation. This is one of the few books. There's only a couple of others that actually zero primarily on one nation. It is not Israel and it is not Judah. It is Edom. The whole prophecy is bent towards Edom. The first part is about the punishment of Edom. Then we go into the crimes of Edom. Then the last section, the focus comes from one nation to all nations. And there we have God's punishment upon the nations. And in this point, again, like when we looked at Joel, the focus moves into the far-off future, no longer simply the immediate situation with one nation. The book, as I suggest, was written by Obadiah, probably in the 9th century BC, and was the first, most likely the first, of all the prophets. The prophecy is not to Israel, as I said, but to Edom, and its message is the day of the Lord. Now, I think we define the day of the Lord as whenever God brings judgment down upon a person, upon a nation. That is the day of the Lord. Of course, there is a time in the future that is called the day of the Lord, when God will bring to book the whole world, which lies in the future. But many nations have their day of the Lord throughout history, when God deals with them. So firstly, we must go back a little bit to see some background to Edom, or to Esau, and to Jacob. It is the saga of two brothers, Jacob and Esau. So it began a long time ago. It began a long time before this prophecy was ever penned, the saga of these two brothers. They engaged in a feud that began in the womb of Rebekah. Rebekah and Isaac were their parents. Rebekah had twin boys, and in the womb, the Bible says, they struggled together. So this is a pretty deep-seated feud, isn't it, when it begins right back there. When Esau was born, the firstborn, Jacob had a hold of his heel as they were born. As Esau came out, Jacob's got a hold of him. And that became the tenor of their existence from then on. Well, what do we have here? We have a feud. You heard about the Hatfields and the McCoys? You have? In America? It started in the Civil War and went for 30-odd years. Through the Civil War and out the other side, these two families, West Virginia, Kentucky, were at each other's throats. Dozens, actually, were either killed or wounded as a result of this feud, and it took a long, long time for it finally to work out and the feud to cease. Well, here we have a feud that's probably went for a couple of thousand years, beginning at birth and persisted right through. The Lord said to Rebekah in Genesis, two nations are in your womb, two peoples from within you shall be divided. One shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. God had said that right back in Genesis. We come forward to the New Testament, the book of Romans chapter 9. Paul says, when Rebekah had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done neither good nor bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of him who called, she was told, the older shall serve the younger. We call this primogenita. You've heard of primogenita? Prime, first, genita means generation, the firstborn. Primogenita means the advantage of the firstborn. In other words, winner take all. Firstborn takes all. The firstborn gets the farm, the double blessing. And that was the point at issue with Esau and Jacob. Esau was the firstborn. He had the right, because of being the firstborn, to the farm, to the wealth, to the family, to everything that involved the family, and as well to the blessing of God and to the promises of God that had been given to Abraham, down to Isaac, and they should have gone down to Esau. But we never say Abraham, Isaac, and Esau. We say Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, secondborn. So the rule was broken in respect of the secondborn, Jacob. So the birthright belonged to Esau, but Jacob took it. How did he get that birthright? Well, firstly, he got it by opportunism and by deal-making. I guess he was a Jew, very good at deal-making. So what happened? Esau comes in from hunting because he was a man of the outdoors. He was exhausted. He was hungry. He wanted something to eat. And Jacob was there making the stew. And Jacob said, I'll do a deal. You can have my stew. I'll have your birthright. Esau, the New Testament tells us, was a profane man and had put no store or value by the birthright. Not in the physical sense or the material sense, but certainly in the spiritual sense. He was not a spiritual man. He was a profane man. And he sold it. What's the use of that to me? I'm dying, he said. You can have it. Okay, that's fine. Then we come to the time when Isaac was dying. He could hardly see. His eyes were dim. And he said to his oldest son, Esau, go out and get me venison, which my soul loves. Bring it to me, and I will bless you. He intended to bless his oldest son, his favorite son. Remember, Jacob was the favorite of Rebekah, but Esau was the favorite of Isaac. So, standing in the flaps of the tent was Rebekah. She hears it. So she cooks up a little idea, a little plan. And she says to her son, Jacob, I want you to put fur on your arms because your brother is a hairy man and you're a smooth man. And I want you to smell like the earth. And I'm going to cook up this little bit of a calf, whatever it was. And I'm going to dress it up like venison. And I want you to go in and pretend that you are your brother. And you will get the blessing of your father. And that is exactly what happened. Isaac, in his almost blind state, says, you feel like Esau, but you sound like Jacob. But nevertheless, he blessed him. And shortly after he had blessed him, in comes Esau with his venison, realizing he had been tricked, this time by pure deception. So what did Jacob engage himself in? Firstly, deal-making, and then deception. Pure, outright deception. We say, well, how come he was allowed to have it? Well, I have no doubt that God would have brought about his purposes, because it says way back in Genesis that the older shall serve the younger. God had determined this anyway. They did not need to deceive, but nevertheless, that's what they did. So now we have the opportunistic, the deal-making, and the deceptive Esau having won everything. Winner takes all. How do you think that was going to work out in family relationships from then on? You know, when they come to the next wedding and they're all there, how are they going to get on? How are they going to talk, you know? You know what they say about when weddings happen? All the family comes and all the old feuds rise up, you know, the old disagreements. Well, it wasn't going to be too good. And Esau knew, Jacob knew it, and Rebekah knew it. And so she packs off his son back to her homeland, to her own family, for his own safety. And of course, then you know what happened when Jacob went back to Ur of the Chaldees and met the family and so on and so on. Well, finally the day comes when he returns, of course, and he is dead scared. This is Jacob. He really is scared because he's going to meet Esau. By this time, Esau's anger has somewhat, you know, come down a notch or two. And so he didn't kill him. But nevertheless, that old antagonism, that old grudge bearing was going to continue and was going to persist right through into their families. A perpetual grudge. When Israel came out of Egypt after their 400 years of slavery, they came up the east side of the Rift Valley where that runs down to the Gulf of Aqaba, the home of Esau, Mount Seir, and they wanted to go through the land of Edom to go up and then cross Jordan opposite Jericho. But the Edomites would not let them. "We will not let you come through our land." It was going to be much more difficult now because they're going to have to travel a lot further to circumnavigate around Edom to go up into the promised land. But there you have the same old thing persisting, the same antagonism. So Esau moved to Mount Seir. That's where he lived. Here is the location. You see the Rift Valley. The Rift Valley really runs right through the middle of Edom, right down to the Gulf of Aqaba. And so Edom, or Esau, set up in Mount Seir, which was, it's not marked there, but it's over to the right-hand side, to the eastern side of that Rift Valley. So you have Sela, and then north of that you had Bozrah. Essentially, that's the side they lived. But, of course, they covered the whole area. I want you to notice Idumea, that little place there. That's where the Edomites were. They were pushed up into Idumea when the Nabataeans came in from Arabia. They pushed them out and displaced them. And so the Edomites ended up living in Idumea. Now, Idumea is actually part of Israel. So this was the beginning of their losing their identity when they moved into Idumea. Well, the Edomites lived in their carved-out dwellings. They lived high in Mount Seir. They lived in caves. And they said to themselves, "No one can bring us down." Edom finally became a satellite of Israel. During the Davidic kingdom and the kingdom under Solomon, they were oppressed or suppressed, I suppose. Edom was there, but never had any great strength. It never actually ever had any great power in the whole existence of Edom. And they lived under the shadow of the older brother, Jacob, in Israel. Nevertheless, pride and hatred was the problem of Edom. Whenever Judah was attacked by other nations, by Egypt, by the Philistines, by the Arabians, the Edomites would join in. And we see that in that prophecy. They would come in on their coattails. They were never strong enough to attack Israel alone, but they would always join someone else who did. And so when the Philistines and the Arabs attacked, or the Ethiopians attacked, then they would be there to do it. When the Babylonians attacked also, and they took them into exile, the Edomites joined the Babylonians, ransacking the cities. That is why Psalm 137 says, "Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, 'Raise it, or lay it bare, even to its foundations.'" So Edom was there cheering when the Babylonians were sacking Jerusalem and said, you know, "Burn it completely." Yet, in Deuteronomy, we read, God told Israel, "You shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother." So Israel was never allowed to do the sort of thing to the Edomites that they were doing to the Israelites. As I said, they never built Petra. It was the Nabataeans who did that. And finally, they were driven out of Judah into Idumea. Then when the Jews returned in the Persian era, to rebuild Jerusalem, to rebuild the temple. The Edomites were made to give back cities to the Jews. And then during the time of the Maccabees, that is the intertestamental period, they were forced to convert to Judaism. So a whole family, the Edomites that were left, essentially became Jews. And we have names like Herod the Great appearing, who was an Edomite. He was not a Jew, he was from Edom. And he essentially bought his monarchy, being king, from the Caesars, and became like a puppet king of Judah. And hence was not altogether a popular man as far as the Jew was concerned. But he had this power. He'd bought it, and that was it. So we have Herod the Great. He was the one responsible for the slaughter of the innocents. Remember when all the children were slain from up to 2 years of age because he'd heard the king of the Jews had been born, and he wanted no king other than himself. And so he ordered the slaying of every boy child up to 2 years of age. It was his son, Herod Antipas, who killed John the Baptist. And it was his grandson, Agrippa II, who was eaten of worms in Acts 12. Remember, he had some people from Tyre and Sidon come up, and they had a dispute with Herod Antipas, and they wanted to make peace. And Herod made a speech, and all the people of Sidon and Tyre, they said, it's the voice of a god, not a man. And suddenly the angel of the Lord struck him, it says, because he received this praise as a god, and he was eaten of worms. Well, that was Herod Antipas the first, Agrippa the first, then Agrippa the second. He died without children, and that was the end of the Idumean kingdom. There was no more Edomites to be found. They disappeared completely from history. That is why it says, because of violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. Again, there's our outline. First of all, one nation, then secondly, all nations. Let's have a look now at the first section, the punishment. It goes the punishment, and then it goes the crimes of Edom. So the punishment of Edom. Number one, God will bring you down. Now, looking at the verses that we had up there before, that we read before, the call is there to rise up and from among the nations to utterly destroy Edom. The pride of your heart has deceived you. So this is the punishment. You live in the clefts of the rock. Lofty dwellings is where you live. And you say, who will bring me down? Though you soar aloft like an eagle, you nest among the stars, yet I will bring you down. So God promises, I'm going to bring you down. Number two, it will be a complete destruction. Now he says here that plunderers come by night, like thieves come by night, and they take what they want out of your house. But they don't take everything. But not so with Edom. Everything was gone. He was stripped bare. The grape gatherers, they come, and but they leave the gleanings. They take the grapes, what falls to the ground they leave. But not in the case of Edom, not in the case of Esau. How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. It is going to be a complete decimation, God promises. Number three, your allies have deceived you. Your allies have driven you to the border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. Those who eat your bread have set a trap beneath you. So this is going to be the case for Edom. Those, my friends, those I eat bread with, those I'm allied with, all of them are going to set their face against me. Number four, you shall lose your wise and mighty men. Note he lists the wise men, the understanding men, the mighty men. Every nation, of course, requires certain people with certain skills to function. And I was thinking about the Cultural Revolution in China back in the 70s. I remember reading as it was happening, it sounded terrible what was going on there. But anybody of any capability was targeted by Mao Zedong and all those who were with him, because that's the kind of people they did not want. Almost if you wore glasses, that means you could read, therefore you were targeted. And we have seen this throughout history, time and time again. In order to subdue and subjugate a people, an enemy will target the capable ones in that society. We go then to the second part, the crimes of Edom. What did they do? What did they do to bring all this sort of thing upon them? Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. I want you to look at the verbs that I have highlighted here. This is what they have done. They have stood aloof. When the invader came in, they stood aloof. No, we're standing back here. We're not doing anything. We're just letting it happen. You were like one of them, God says to the Edomites. You were like the Babylonians who came in to destroy. You were like the Assyrians. You were like those of Philistia who came in. You gloated over them in the day of your brother. The day your brother suffered, you gloated over that. And you rejoiced over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. You boasted, and you also entered the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. You looted his wealth. You stood at the crossroads. In other words, when the escapees came out of the cities, the Edomites stood at the crossroads to cut off their escape. And then it says, you handed over the survivors in the day of their distress. This was what Esau did to his brother Jacob. Secondly, now we're looking at the second part, the day of the Lord. Now we've moved to the punishment of the nations. Note again the prophetic perspective that we looked at once before, last time when I speak about Joel, that in Old Testament prophecies, the first view you have is of the immediate. And then there is a long-term view. Every prophecy has a fulfillment that is near and then a fulfillment that is far off. Here we have moved to the far-off fulfillment. It is not now just Edom, but it is all nations. So look here at these two scriptures. Now, verse 15 from Obadiah. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. So I've highlighted all the nations. As you have done. Now I've highlighted as you have done. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall be returned upon your own head. Now look at Matthew 25, Jesus speaking. Before him were gathered all the nations. And he will separate people from people as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And then a few verses down further. As you did it to the least of these, brothers of mine, you did it to me. So we are drawing a parallel now between the all nations of Obadiah and when Jesus speaks of dealing with all the nations. The rule will be, the measure will be, as you have done. As you have done it to them, it will be done to you. Now, in that day that lies yet future, as you did it to the least of these. And who are these? Of course, we looked at that in Joel. It is my brothers. It is Israel. It is those who are going to suffer particularly in that dreadful period called the tribulation in a day yet to come. They will be the target of he who is the Antichrist, the beast, the one who targets God and God's people again in a historical sense. And then to them, if you have drunk of my holy mountain, the cup of judgment, all nations will drink continually. They will drink and they will swallow this judgment and shall be as though they had never been. So again, there are going to be nations that shall be as though they have never been. We know that at this particular point, at this judgment, when God separates sheep from the goats, it's going to be a judgment of the nations. And we understand that nations are going to persist even into this glorious period called the millennium. Nations will be, but some nations will not be. There are some nations that are going to be missing. And it's going to be according to this rule as to whether they are there or not. Now, the nation of Egypt, for example, is going to persist into the millennium. In fact, God is going to set up an altar in the nation of Israel, of Egypt, to worship God. So are there going to be those nations that worship God? There are going to be those nations that did well to these, the least of my brothers. But there are going to be those who will not have a representative there at all in that day. We do tend to think in the church in ethereals, you know, ethereal sense, that the future kind of is something you can't put your finger on. But no, it's going to be a real future. There's going to be real things, real nations. Except that the glory of the Lord will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. And Christ will rule. We cannot comprehend this. All we can say is, this is what we need. We need something that's much better than what we've got now. And it shall come to pass in a day. Yeah, as far out of our comprehension as this may be, as far away from our experience as this may be, it shall be when he shall rule. Well, Israel shall possess Edom. So what he's saying in this passage is that what was Edom is now going to be part of Israel, because it always actually was a part of promised Israel. The borders of Israel that God gave to Abraham right back in Genesis were far greater than what we see today. Even the minuscule part that is what we call Israel today is very, very small compared with what God promised to Abraham. What God promised to Abraham went all the way across to Egypt, even taking part of Egypt, went all the way north, taking most of Syria, taking half of Iraq, and then all the way down the south, Edom and so on. It's a monstrous area. And all of this is going to be Israel in that day. It's going to be the Middle East. When you look, if you actually trace it on a map, it is the Middle East. It's a whole section. The whole of Jordan, the whole of Transjordan it was promised to Abraham. And let's go on. The possessions. The house of Jacob, yes. And then, so we have the demise of Edom, and how Jacob is going to possess them. Now look from verse 19 onwards. Those of the Negeb shall possess Mount Esau. I've just highlighted the words possess, possess, possess. In every case, it is a part of Israel possessing a part of Edom. So Israel shall possess these places. And then in verse 21, deliverers or judges or saviors shall go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau. So there shall be, so Edom or Esau, Mount Esau or Mount Seir shall be ruled from Jerusalem in that day. And the kingdom shall be the Lord's. And in Mount Zion there shall be those who escape, that is the Israelites, and it shall be holy. When we pray, thy kingdom come, it is this for which we're praying. When the kingdom shall be the Lord's. When the glory of the Lord covers the earth as the waters cover the sea, that is what we pray for. Thy kingdom come. And then Zechariah, the Lord shall be king over all the earth, and there shall be one Lord and his name one. So what do we learn from this? Number one, we learn that justice shall be brought down in respect of everything. Whether we are thinking of angels or nations or governments or cultures or people or Israel or the church, whatever, God's judgment shall be done and brought down and brought to pass. Nothing shall pass. You know, we look at the injustice that happens around us and we say, when's this going to be brought to the bar? And we think, oh, well, maybe never. You know, perpetrators of great injustice, when they're finally cornered, often commit suicide, as if, okay, that's it, I'm out of here. No, it shall not be. It shall not be. Justice shall be done and shall be seen to be done in that day. Some time ago, I did a series of studies for the book of Revelation, and that was the one thing that struck me. God has plenty of time, and he will judge everything particularly and fully, all in its time, one step at a time. He will do it. Nothing shall be left undone when it comes to his justice. It was a German poet who wrote these words. Though the mills of the gods, so the mills of gods grind slowly, yet they grind exceeding small. Though with patience he stands waiting with exactness, grinds he all. Number two, the purposes of God are greater than the church. Gentile arrogance has sidelined any future for Israel. in many quarters of the church. There's simply nothing going to happen. That is arrogance. Not only that, it is failure to believe the Bible, failure to believe what it clearly says. And number three, all of God's promises will be completely fulfilled, absolutely, without exception. Amen. Lord bless you.
Thanks, Peter. Okay, so we're going to have tea and coffee up the back. Before we do, we're going to say a quick prayer. Just to remind everyone as well.